I put the handouts over there, and the title of this workshop is Reimagining Theological Education with the Church, Developing Learning Partnerships for Nurturing Effective Leadership for the 21st Century Church. And that obviously suggests that educational structures should change too. And I think in this particular track, we've been talking about the ills of the present system, the present traditional system, and I'm trying to address some of those issues. And I'm not trying to solve the problem of the world, all the problems of the world, all the problems of the theological seminary world, but I'm trying to address one aspect of it. I think I need to say right from the beginning that I'm not trying to address directly the spiritual formation aspect of theological education with this particular alternative, which I would like to say is complementary to the traditional system. If you look at the handout, you will note that the workshop notes are divided into three sections. Section one is a common description of the traditional seminary educational paradigm, and I have diagrammed it over there. The traditional seminary education paradigm, where knowledge is structured into different departments and where there is very little integration of knowledge acquired from these different departments. They are developed what has been called a guild mentality, which excludes non-specialists from its membership. And the other point we note about this paradigm is that canons of knowledge are relatively fixed. And there isn't a very strong emphasis on the application, or should I say the discerning application of knowledge to real life issues in the church. Now, I don't have time, and I don't think it's desirable for us to go through all the details in the first page of the handout. You can read, and I don't want to repeat everything. But the descriptions there are to illustrate the fact that the educational structures and the socializing processes within the structures shape our graduates into what they are. And what they are is exactly the sort of complaints that we've heard repeatedly in this educational track. Educational stroke leadership track, I would add. Now, one of the metaphors which has been used to describe seminary graduates is that they are like qualified pilots who have very little flight experience. Or they can say, you know, I can fly the plane, but when we come to a storm situation, we don't know how to handle the plane. Or they are like the medical graduates who have very little clinical experience, and they can treat minor cuts and possibly little cuts in the hand. no reference to Ravi Zacharias thing. That's really dangerous. But you know, they can treat the basic, but you know, when it comes to deeper, more complex issues, they don't know how to deal with those issues. And the big question is, would you trust yourself to such pilots, to such doctors? Would you trust yourself to such church leaders, such leaders of the church? Now, story, I tell my students to encourage them to balance theory and practice, to balance service and scholarship, or scholarship and service, is a fairy tale about a wicked giant and a little child. Now, imagine a situation where a wicked giant has captured a little child. A wicked giant has captured a little child. Now, what happens when a wicked giant captures a little child? Now, what you do is you create a need for the child to be rescued. And to do that, you need to send troops to the giant's castle, which is located high up there in the mountains. Now, you need to organize rescue attempts to save the child, as well as to keep future kidnapping threats in check. Now, if you're in the business of training these troops in the rescue team, what is the nature of the training for them? What would you include in your curriculum? Now, let me suggest a couple of topics which might be useful to teach the troops. I think it might be useful to teach psychology and habitual behavior of wicked giants. Maybe the physiology of wicked giants or adult giants. Perhaps we need to teach about the psychology of distressed children. Or perhaps the architecture and layouts of giant castles, or types of materials that you use as sword blades, or recent innovation in sword technology, or teach them about sword fighting manuals, or the power of the sword. Now, we do that, some of that, but so much of theological education, or so much of the education that we do for that kind of work, just to use a parallel, you know, it takes us down into the sword production factories where we study the atomic structures of the metals used to make swords. Or we study the, we have, you know, taxonomy of swords. We study the history of sword making. And in all that specialized study, we have forgotten about the child. We have forgotten about our mission. We have forgotten the rationale for our study. Now, by all means, become a specialist and work on better materials for the sword hilt or the hand grip of the sword so that it becomes more useful. Understand the processes of giant cognitive development, but do it with a missional goal in mind. And what we see in section one in the handout is therefore the tendency for the traditional paradigm to produce graduates who then become leaders in churches but who are ill-prepared to deal with the complex challenges of the 21st century which are found in the church. Now, this therefore takes me to the second section, and I've not bothered to explain all that you see in the handout. I think some of it, most of it, is self-explanatory. If you need to ask a question, I'll be happy to address that. But this description, and it's not unique to me, I've just tried to put it down in a diagram. This takes me to the second section, which is found on page 2 and which is entitled Reimagining Theological Education, Moving Beyond and Modifying the Existing System. Now, please note what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we replace one model with the other. I think Ralph Enloe mentioned the point earlier that these institutions are here to stay, and I have worked for at least 8 years, more than 8 years, from within the institution. I stand within the institution. I know it's not going to go away. So I'm not saying we replace one model with the other. Now, in a sense, section one is really pointing to the weakness of a well-established model of education, but there are strengths in it. I want to say this, that there are strengths in that system. There are also weaknesses, and that's what I'm trying to address, but I want to affirm the strength that we find in this traditional model. I think many of us were blessed listening to Dr. Carson and how we saw him deal with Scripture. And that is really an example of what happens in the traditional system, where perspective is gained, a proper perspective is gained over time. You know, when new information is given, providing an overview on a topic, you know, you need the efficiency of the lecture system in order to gain that perspective in a short time. So I'm affirming that, but I'm also pointing to weaknesses and also pointing to the fact that there are alternative models which can be used in combination with the traditional paradigm, which together will result in a better prepared set of church leaders. Now, the one complementary model which I wish to introduce to us is called problem-based learning. Now, it has been used successfully in the medical, in the nursing profession, in the engineering, in law schools, in business schools, in MBA programs, and increasingly we find them in elementary and secondary schools. And I would really like to say also that yes, it started as a U.S. model. It is often associated with the McMaster's University, which is a medical school. But I would like to say also that the very, very successful problem-based learning schools are not just in the U.S. There are many, many schools in U.K., in Holland. Maastricht University is doing it very well. In Denmark, Aalborg is just off the record, and I know it's not on tape, so I'll say this. But in Singapore, that's where I come from. In Singapore, we recently started the polytechnic, which is called the Republic Polytechnic. And I was thinking in my mind, we have enough polytechnics, we have enough higher institutions, educational institutions. Why start a new polytechnic? And if you research the rationale behind why they started Republic Polytechnic, it's because they have committed themselves, I think it's 25% or 30% of the curriculum to PBL. And the person who went over to help them start it was somebody, I think it was the dean or something, from Aalborg in Denmark. It's an engineering school, but the point is, it's not an American thing. It's really very strongly and increasingly an European phenomenon, very, very successful over there. Now, PBL is therefore itself an established educational paradigm which situates your learning in real-life context and forces you to make tough decisions. Now, in some cases, these tough decisions that you make are under real-life conditions which come complete with real emotional stresses. Now, if you look at the quotation in the box, in the handout, at the top of page 2, the quotation was taken from an article about leadership education amongst educational administrators. Now, read with me from the second line in the second paragraph. In traditional leadership programs, students occupy a passive, individualistic, subordinate role rather than an active, interdependent, superordinate role. Students also learn in an emotional climate much more placid and neutral than the one leaders face. Finally, the relatively slow tempo of the student's classroom role contrasts sharply with the accelerated work pace of an administrator. And of course, he's talking about the professional life of an educational administrator and what they do. With this kind of preparation, graduates of these programs experience reality shock when they start working as leaders. They feel ill-prepared to deal with the emotional and cognitive demands of the role and often suffer from what has been called analysis paralysis. Now, in the same article, there was a very interesting note about Stanford University. It is American, I do apologize. And very interesting note about Stanford University educational leadership program where PBL occupies 40% of the curriculum time. Now, personally, I think that for an institution of higher learning, 40% is a really huge amount of time within the curriculum. But those enrolled in the program were asked if they should increase the PBL curriculum time or decrease it. And you know what they all said? It is too intense to increase it, but it's too valuable to reduce it. Too intense to increase it, but too valuable to reduce it. This is from seasoned practitioners who are going in and now learning the ropes of educational administration. What problem-based learning does therefore, is to introduce students to realities which they will encounter in their professional life, and in our case, in church ministry life. Now, through PBL, problem-based learning, students and other participants can integrate the content they learn from the traditional seminary education with real life context. And I must stress, when I say real life context, it's got to be. You see, for me, as an Asian working in Singapore, I have my context, and I can write cases about my case which are completely irrelevant to the Danish, American, whatever situation that you all belong to. Real life context within your situation. I would add, there are global issues which sometimes have got local expressions. That is a common thing. You know, people are talking about globalization and the local expressions of globalization, and there's a new term which is kind of floating around, which is called glocalization. And glocalization is, you know, the local expressions of these global realities which are coming into our countries. And probably the commonest example you would see is the McDonald's. You know, it's a global phenomenon. But if you go to McDonald's in Thailand, you have your is it tom yum or something? You know, some form of burger which has got a Thai flavor to it. And you know, in California or in Mexico, you probably have some fajita or something. You know, and you find that there is a global expression. Local expression of a global reality, and we cannot move away, we cannot run away from these global realities. So, integration of content with real-life context, and the best thing is that you work out solutions together as a learning community, where you can tap on each other's wisdom and experience and develop what I call practiced discernment. PBL therefore keeps the three C's together: theoretical content, ministry context, and the learning hermeneutical community. CCC, content, context, and community. Now, if you look at the left diagram in page 2, which says problem-based case scenarios, you will find that each case is a real-life ministry situation which you can experience vicariously as you research and as you work on the problems together. You research it as an individual or as a group. You work the problem together as a group. Now, each case, you might want to say, represents a slice of the reality out there that church leaders will very likely face. Now, Harvard Business School uses the case problem-solving method extensively in the MBA program. I read someplace that in the Harvard Business School MBA program, students work through 900 cases in about 2.5 years. Now, that is a lot of reality which is experienced. That is a lot of wisdom which is gained through working out issues together with colleagues who face similar challenges in their professional context. How prepared, I want to ask that question, how prepared, and that question is reflected in the handout also, how prepared would someone who wants to be a leader in the church be for the ministry, for the challenges of ministry, if he did, or if she did, traditional seminary education while at the same time working through, say, 50 cases over time? I want to stop here and leave that thought, or leave that question with us. And I want to switch the time now from a lecture mode to a discussion mode, because that really is the heart of what I'm trying to do, to give us a PBL learning experience. And I've created a case here for us to look at. This is a case which is designed at a higher education level. It's not just meant for discussion. It's meant to involve readings, prior readings. This is an 8-hour experience. We're just going to be looking at it and possibly read it and do a couple of questions just to get a taste of how PBL could be. 50 cases, 20 cases, 10 cases, that's what I'm suggesting. Put them together, and if you look at the diagram, as one goes through these experiences, and experiences which give us a taste of reality out there, we tap on the experiences of different people. How then would a person who has gone through multiple experiences, not just one, I would hasten to add, it's not the one case that makes the difference. It's the series that you go through that will help in your development and your preparedness in ministry. So I want to just turn this time over to us, and I'm going to take off the mic. And is that the best way to do it?
I'll tell them what you're doing.
Okay.
If it ends up being dead, then or muffled, they'll come running in.
Okay. All right.
You can take it off.
Okay. All right. So we're going to do a problem-based learning experience, an 8-hour experience minimum. Now, 8 hour is just staging time, i.e. the time that we have together. It presumes prior readings, etc. So it's hard work getting yourself ready for this.
8 hours in one
shot? No. If you look at it, I've in my handout, I've written the... let me see, where is it? Okay. Length of time staging, the very first page, you see, one Friday evening, and you know, the day and all is really up to you to sort out, but one Friday evening, 2 hours, and one Saturday, which is 6 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the morning, and 3 hours in the afternoon, and I've only done it this way because I think it's more efficient to put it together. In some cases, it might be better for you to spread it over a much longer time. With more complex cases, for example, if I ask you to do some legal research on battered wives, you know, you might have to go spend some time and do some prior research. That might take time, and that information might only the need for that information might only surface after the first or second session, and you might need a week to do that. You see, so I'm going to shut up right now, and let us read. Let's just give ourselves maybe 40 minutes or half an hour to work on this. And I really want to move on to the final point, which is, you know, as we begin to see how this possibly can be used as a tool, my main point really is about learning partnerships between church and seminary. How then can we develop learning partnerships using this as a tool?
So we think this is going to be used at the seminar.
It has multiple uses. It can happen any place. If, for example, I say, in my school, I've carved out 10% of my time to do this. Now, remember, PBL is not specific to subject. It's intended to integrate multiple disciplines. You're supposed to draw from different disciplines. And you could even make this your graduation piece, where you have 3 months where you devote yourself to a series of 10 cases. Or you can think in terms of development for church leaders. And you could even do it from the end of, from the church point of view. I mean, the church wants to take up this as a project to help the seminary students. That's one way of doing it. That's one use of it. If I do this to help church leaders have an ongoing professional development, educational experience over 10 years, I will continue to write cases and get people committed to the course to write cases to help pastors develop and grow. That's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah. And what I'm really trying to do with a group of people is we've already got a network up to work over time and to collect cases that people can access over the internet. And we can participate in learning experiences from the internet. You can be in Denmark, I can be in Singapore, Ron can be in Portugal, and we could be addressing the same issue as a group, as a learning community. Yeah, and that's the point. So that's Would you like to work through some of this? I must say I was a bit uncomfortable doing the research for this. It's just like, you know, getting a couple of paper cuts in some of this. Because the pictures that you see here have a before frame and an after frame, you know. And some of the pictures that you get in these, what we call graphic novels, which is the area of research and the emerging reality that we're dealing with in this case, are really the stuff that our people feed their minds on. And I was, you know, obviously a bit uncomfortable working through this. But I really wanted us to use our imagination and to imagine what could have been the before frame and the after frame to help us to enter into the world just a little bit of some of our young people today. Because this is a reality, I can tell you it's a reality, it's a global reality. Did I give you one of these?
No.
That's the case that we're working on.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. Did you find that useful?
And I used to teach problem analysis.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
The engineers and stuff like that.
And in fact, that point is a useful point because problem-based learning is not about problem solving. Per se, it's also about problem posing and analysis, as you say. Yeah. You want to just enter into an actual experience, or you know, where we can actually discuss the case. And just to give us a feel of it. Or would you prefer to just, you know, talk about the case and, you know, not actually do the case itself?
Perhaps it's better if you could tell us what you think are the advantages by using this compared with the more traditional.
Yeah. Well, the question that is raised here, in case of you cannot hear this, is the, I guess, posing the relative advantages of problem-based learning over the traditional way. I've kind of addressed some of that already, although, you see, the thing I really hate to do is to present the worst of one system and then begin to introduce the best in one system, because that's really unfair. And as I've said earlier, I really want to uphold the good in the existing system. I think, let me see, where do I have it? In the bibliography that I have, I do have a bibliography someplace. It's in the other handout, the first handout. Page 4 in the PBL resources, and if you look at that, I've actually focused a lot on internet resources, and the answer that you're asking me, the answer to the question you're asking me can really be found in many of these websites, and they're some of them are really, really good. Quick access into the sort of information that you need. But if you look at the books, I've listed three books and one article. The second book I would highly recommend because it gives you the theoretical basis for that. You know, it does look at it very carefully. The fourth, or the final, the one by Savin Baden, I'm probably not even pronouncing it properly, that one is interesting because it's about untold stories. It's looking at the bad side of it. Because people say, oh, PBL is going to save the world. You know, it's going to transform your education. yeah, it's going to make a difference, but please know that there are weaknesses in it. And I think one of the weaknesses I would like to point out to in PBL is the fact that in order to maximize a learning experience, a discussion, what we call discussion pedagogy, you know, learning by tapping on each other, part of the problem is sometimes we don't know how to engage in dialogue, in academic dialogue. There are times when I've discovered you have to shut up. If you're a powerful contributor, or if you're a repeated contributor, you need to shut up. That's the best thing you should do. And if you look at how dialogues go, there's the movers. Somebody shares an idea. Somebody supports the idea. Somebody challenges the idea. Somebody synthesizes the idea. You need four different dialogue partners in order to maximize your dialogue. If everybody says yes, 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 it's not going to move. So knowing how to discuss, you know, knowing how to engage in good academic discussion, I think is extremely important. Otherwise, you don't get a very engaging dialogue. You might as well go and listen to a lecture or read a book. So that's... I'm not sure whether I've answered your question. Your question is the difference and what difference it makes.
The advantages.
If I may just add, one of the problems with the traditional learning experience is, you know, I was talking to Ron earlier about how in the traditional lecture we talk about how it's really an efficient way of communicating information. The reality is it's a very efficient way of, if you think in terms of a jug of water, it's really, the lecture is a very efficient way of pouring water or emptying water out of that jug, which you pour on a glass or many, many glasses, and you find that half the water is not going into the glass. Why? Because if I'm tired, the water doesn't go inside. If I need to go to the toilet right now, the water doesn't go inside. If it's too cold, it's too hot, the water doesn't go inside. And then even though you listened to D.A. Carson and you were so mesmerized for that evening, when you have left, 2 weeks later, not even 2 weeks later, 2 hours later, half of it is gone. No, not half. Most of it is gone. We forget that there's a hole in the glass or hole in the bucket. And that explains the diagram I've put in the handout, that there's a bucket and the water is not really inside. Plus, the water does not transform the vehicle. Okay? My point is that it's not about transmission, it's about conservation of knowledge. It's about conservation of knowledge. How much of that still remains inside that you can use it effectively for ministry? And I would suggest to you that if you have an engaging lecture, 50 minutes, you see, the typical seminary is you have a whole half-day class. And what happens is you have learning fatigue. If everybody was a D.A. Carson and you were so mesmerized, you would still not remember because it's very tiring. PBL is interesting because it makes you involved. We talked about it earlier in the presentation. There's an affective dimension. When that happens, you see, in PBL, I could create a situation that forces you to go and read John chapter 1 because you need to find the answer. Somebody's going to die. Somebody's going to be led to heresy, and I need to find the answer, and that drives you to discover the answer. So it does operate on sound educational theory. And I don't even really need to name that theory because you know from experience, it's been attested by your experience. that your retention rate is so much higher. You remember those learning experiences. I really don't want to say anything more because I really want to throw the ball into your court. Maybe if you can make some comments about this. And I deliberately did not write a perfect case here because it was an invitation for you to fill in the blanks and to help craft it. This is a learning partnership after all.
Yeah. Well, I'm of course not involved in Christian education, but I was involved in educating adults in a manufacturing type of an environment. And the lecture approach that we had used for a great deal of time in our industry. We made trucks and buses and diesel engines primarily. And we found that the retention of what it is we were trying to teach our people was, as you were saying, it was almost a little bit like an empty can. I mean, it had all the shapes and form of a can, and you thought it had a bottom, but somehow or another it was all leaking out. So what we did is that we banded with several educational development companies and came up with a series of programs where we began to institute an actual problem-solving type of activity in which it wasn't any longer just talking about it, it was actually doing the work. And in some instances, once they learned how to develop the process, we actually then had real live cases that we would go out into the manufacturing environment and go through using the processes to see whether or not they actually had learned anything. And again, I think the appropriateness of what you're saying really is in the learning aspect as opposed to the teaching aspect. Not that teaching isn't important, but it really does take the attention or the primary attention off of the actual teaching activity and the teacher and whether or not the teacher is quote-unquote getting the word out properly and now beginning to concentrate on whether the learner is actually learning or not. And that experience is so valuable because one of the simplest things in problem analysis, of course, is not necessarily jumping in to solve the problem because that's a result-oriented type of activity. And if you have a very intense leader, that you're going to come up with a answer. It may not be the right answer, but it will be an answer. And this way, what happens is that you immediately start out by something very simple, and that is, what is in problem solving, what is the object and what is the defect? Now, in a manufacturing environment, the object might be a piece of equipment that isn't operating properly, and the defect is, well, it's not working. So what you're really trying to do is get the learners then to understand not only the process steps, but also that in order to come to the results, the most effective result, by following those processes, you can come up with usually the answer, and then you prove it out by just through some type of an experimentation, something along that line. So I can see that, you know, I had never thought of it in terms of actually being used in Christian education and leadership development, but I would think that that you could do that, you know, and I can see the value. So that the problem itself now becomes how to, in problem analysis, it then shifts to what is called root cause analysis. So now you're going that extra layer and not only fixing what's wrong with it, but now you get to the other layer underneath which says, well, what is causing it? And once you get to causation, now you can begin to go at it from a completely different a different point of view. But it takes it out of the realm of theoretical and just acquiring some really good knowledge with the hope that it might be applied
and you actually put it into an application. Sometimes they're staged, but a lot of times they're actually real problems. And it works. It really does work. And once they understand what the process is, it's not really meant to be a process that's used exclusively by the manager or the supervisor. It's the idea that once you learn how to use the process, then anybody can use it and anybody can make the observations and draw teams together. And team-type activities, it works very well, particularly if you've got people who all understand the same thing. I don't know if that was helpful or not.
Yeah. Any thoughts amongst the theological educators? Theological what? Theological educators.
My problem is that I hear our teachers, they have done two courses where they have also been working with these things,
PBL.
But afterwards they will say, we have prepared lessons we have used for many years, and it's very difficult for them. I experience that they just can't overcome to make that transition to a new situation. So probably they need to have something very practical put into their hands. I mean, it is not so easy to make these cases.
One thing that I found, and I work primarily with young people, university students. And as I'm reading this particular case study, I've already read through it, I kind of feel like the parents, I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but, the kids are doing things, the parents don't know it, they're shocked, they're appalled by the actual behavior. And I find that that's often true in my ministry. I'm leading an internship for a year with these young students, and they're doing things that I don't really approve of, but I don't know it. And so there's different ways that I can, I can try to police it. I can try to get somebody to tell them. I don't really want to do that. Or I can get them to open up and just to talk about real life issues. And of course, I can ask them pointed questions. If there's a trust relationship, they will respond. And so I think this type of methodology, because it does touch on the real world, without necessarily having to use my life as an example or their life as an example, it's not too close to home so that it shuts down the, embarrassing moments and people don't want to talk because they're afraid it's going to be too revealing for themselves. But at the same time, it's close enough to reality that it lets you know what they're sort of thinking under the surface. If you start to have good conversation and really engage and interact, and they're really getting involved in it, then you begin to, I think, know them at a deeper level. So I think it's just one methodology of getting to know them and helping to build some trust so that there's more openness to discuss things of a serious nature.
I found that, I was directing this at people who were in leadership positions who are out of touch of these, not so much out of touch with reality, but out of touch with these emerging realities. And it's natural for us to be out of touch. And, for a group of, say, people who are our age, middle-aged sort of people, your answers will be very indicative of our age. And I think, I think if you get a group of young people to do this, get that feedback, and feed some of that feedback into this, it would really, really help us in terms of our responses. One of the things about PBL is not quite the same as case studies per se, because
PBL tries to replicate some of the emotions and some of the tensions, some of the complexities of it depends on how you do it, but you know, this one is, I put two cases together, and if you have done all your homework, I think you would realize that one case is probably not as problematic, or you know, it could probably be solved. And, this whole idea of Zanger is really, it could be used badly, it could be used well, very well, and I'm intending to do this for as a tool for academic discussion with a group of my colleagues. So there's a good side, there's a bad side to it, but because we tend to react to the unknown in a very similar way, throw it away, chuck it out, censor it, the thing is, you know, I'm trying to ask for informed judgment and judgment with nuance, so that we are saying, hey, there's five issues involved, and we need to deal with each issue differently, because there's a consequence for doing this way and that way, you know, all the problem-posing sort of things. And at the end of the day, really, it's for people not to say, this is what we must do, and the answer is, you know, let's censor it. But really, it's to get nuance and understanding of the situation, and that's why actually the first 2 hours is really for us to go and play around with the genre and to familiarize ourselves with the genre and its different users, and to say, hey, this is not as insidious as we think it really is, it's just that we are unfamiliar with it, you know. So it's so multiple complex situations, breaking it down and responding appropriately.
So then in the vignette, hey, for example, the first step for working with this type of a case problem, case like this, is to identify what the issues are.
Exactly.
And so the issue is really the issue, the computer is the issue, the system itself is the issue, a time element is the issue, a communication element between the girl and her family. Initially, a girl and her mother, now a girl and her father. Now you're even going into another level, which says, well, maybe it's really a church issue, because now we're talking about developing a series of sermons. And, you know, so in that unpacking, what you really, and that's a term I think I've heard here several times during the conference by several of the presenters, and that unpacking, what you're doing is that you're taking a look at all of those issues and what would be the what's the ramification of just dealing with it on a single issue basis, or even if you take all of the issues, how do you take them and construct something that ends up being very positive with that Christian approach involved in it and the Christian aspect of it.
And all of that is reflected in the discussion questions. Namely the issue, looking at possible solutions, causes of action, consequences of causes of action.
This is all reflected in the questions. What I'm going to say is essentially rephrasing what you just said, but just to help me. You know, sometimes it's not so much different issues, but different levels of the same issue. For example, you know, I can relate, obviously, to the parent, you know, to the father. You know, I tend to react authoritatively and sometimes without having full knowledge, you know. And so, you know, I could say, well, you know, why didn't you tell me about this? You know, and deal with the actual issue of, you know, the computer and what she's covering, you know, what she's actually discussing in the phone. That's one level of my communication with my daughter. But this whole issue of, you know, whether I'm too authoritarian and don't listen to her, you know, is another level of communication that's been going on for 13 years, you know, and so maybe I need to back off of that one level of communication and try to work on maybe improving general communication, you know, just so that we can talk openly. And then once we begin to talk openly, then we can maybe move to the actual subject matter that needs addressing. And find that, again, just pulling back a little bit, removing myself from the picture, looking at it more objectively allows me to see those kinds of distinctions.
What you're suggesting, though, is that the case studies that you're talking about, 50 or 60 or whatever number, over the period of the educational life of the student, 3 to 4 years, something along that line, is that, did I read
well,
that?
Well, there are different expressions of this, and it really depends on your host institution.
Ah.
What do you want to do? As you mentioned, it's difficult to convince a bunch of people that PBL, as much as they might see value in it, they don't know how to handle it. Okay, how do we create these cases?
Yeah.
If I can give a bunch of 50 to you, you will use it, but I don't know how to create them. Okay. You could actually get a specialist and reward that specialist so that he becomes the full-time consultant, working closely, asking people, here's a case, how could this be an extension of what you're existing doing already? And get the person to learn a little bit about being
well,
facilitating that learning.
There's a lot of stuff out there. I mean, if you take the time, obviously, someone in your position or my position, I have a book at home, it's sitting on the shelf, I haven't read it yet, but it's a compendium of about 22 cases, I think it is, of intercultural ethics. So we're dealing with, you know, Korean views of infanticide versus, you know, American abortion. You know, I mean, just whatever it might be, it's an author putting together case studies that address issues that are cross-cultural and are ethical issues. Now, you know, it's going to take some time, but I'm sure if I go through that, I'm going to find a few cases that I will find very relevant to teaching maybe ethics, but maybe just cross-cultural understanding, you know, maybe how to read a text. You know, I might be given lessons on how to, you know, get information and find out what the issues are. You know, so all of those are relevant to my purposes for training people to think in Christian worldview. And so you can either hone in on the exact objective of that particular case, or you can deal with principles within the case, you know, and teach other things.
I think one of the issues is access to that sort of thing. And I think there is room for an institution to develop that as its cornerstone graduation piece or something. And have people receive reward, people to do research and writing and to be an extension of the other work that the school is doing. And the other thing I think might be helpful is to develop a clearinghouse. And I'm toying with the idea to have like the University of Delaware has got a wonderful clearinghouse where people from different disciplines post their cases and get, I mean, what you need to do is just register with that site, and you can come from any discipline, from any country, and I'm registered as a theological educator. There's no theological education category, but I found this wonderful case on women's studies. From women's studies is about female circumcision, and this is really useful for missionaries going into certain parts of the world. You know, I can post my case up there. Now, why would I want to do that? You know, because it's not going to help a lot of people in my industry. What I need to do is maybe create a clearinghouse A to Z, and have your different disciplines as entry points to these cases. You know, like I have a couple of educational administration, seminary educational administration cases written already. I worked with a team. I just finished a project with a team, and they have written a couple of cases. Well done, professionally done, similar quality, if not higher, than this. Complete with artifacts, you know, so that you have a letter from the foreign mission, parent mission, saying, no, we're not going to turn you guys loose, we're not going to, you know, let you guys start your local school, because you don't know how to handle it. You are, after all, not American, or, you know, that sort of spirit. Excuse me for the American bashing today.
I've been taking notes.
I apologize profusely.
Show us your name tag. Yeah, right.
Ron Landers.
This is USA, scratch out Singapore.
If you do a clearinghouse and then allow people access to related cases related to preparation of leadership, and you can focus the leadership at different levels. You see, it could be pastoral leadership, it could be administrative leadership. I'm very, very concerned actually about administrative leadership because some of the greatest injustices are committed within theological institutions, you know, and the structures perpetuate those sins. And I think there's a lot that can be done to heal people from within. And, you know, cases like that help people to begin to be aware of some of the systemic sins.
Are the cases that you're looking at or might be of value to the organization or to the people that use it, is there some basis for reality? In other words, that this actually occurred at some point, and what's being done then is to put that case.
And the problem with that is that sometimes it's so close to home, you need to couch it, you need to hide that. I have a stack of close to 20 vignettes, not written up in proper cases. You know, they're descriptions of situations. And that can be converted over time. You know, but there's a problem of, okay, this was written from a particular person standing from within a particular institution. And sometimes when you write the case out, it's so recognizable. I don't have to name the country. I don't, you know, it's there. And that's one of the ethical issues that one has to...
I'm just thinking of some practical ways I might do this myself, and this is brand new here, but you know, I deal with students on a year-long basis, so I have a group of students come in for a year, they leave, another student group comes in for a year, for the most part, and I realize there are things that I learn, you know, by that experience, that are things that I should be addressing, maybe that I've not been attentive enough to, and so, I mean, I could literally, you know, probably write a few cases from my own life experiences with these students 1 year, you know, and then transfer those to the next year, you know, disguise them enough so that, you know, no one would really know. Yeah. But just to keep the ideas flowing of things that are needful topics, you know, that are relevant to the youth or that from my perspective as a trainer I want to be addressing, you know.
And I would like to add that I think it's important for us to be forward-looking and to be keeping abreast with situations.
Yes.
For which reason, I think the whole idea of researching the case rather than just writing the case because it's, you know, it's from my heart, from my experience, but, you know, doing serious research and being rewarded for that research, I think that will bring case writing and case problems will give us a much better set of better quality set of cases traveling to different situations and, you know, writing them professionally, I think, because cases like that can be done badly, they can be written badly, you know, the issues might not be very clear. And part of the reason why I look at this and I say there's a problem with it. I don't know whether you notice it, but I'm saying to myself, I have a problem with it. And I hope you notice there's a problem in some of it. You know, some of the transitions I find are weak. And if I can say to you, you know, if I'm a professional writer and I go to you and I say, you know, Pastor Ron, help me refine this. That's the beginning of what I call a learning partnership. Because I think partnerships are best done from a position of strength and strength. Your strength and my strength. Not from a position of strength and weakness.
Just in case you're interested, Livingstone Corporation in the Eaton area, Dave Bierman, helps
you know, people write. In other words, he has people give him ideas and then they produce it and develop it. So I mean, if you're looking for professional help, in that sense, they are a really available resource.
Do you use a particular model for developing each case?
The format, yeah.
Yeah.
The format I most closely followed is the University of Delaware format. Yeah. And I've encouraged my team to use this format. So I've a few of them which are in that format. And I'm going to be, in 10 days' time, I'm actually going down to the University of Delaware. And Samford University is another school which is very, very into case problem-based learning. And they have one of the gurus in assessment in their school, a national level guru. And we're going to do a visit in Samford later this year. So there's a group of people in our school that's very interested to develop this and to develop what we call a community of practice, which is an international community, to get people involved and to post their cases possibly so that we can benefit each other at church level as well as at seminary level. Yeah.
So that aspect of it would be geared toward Christian community.
Oh yes.
As opposed to reaching out into the secular world.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And we could actually draw in Christians in the marketplace. So, for example, one of the cases could require you to do an Excel spreadsheet, some sort of thing, because in the church you do have accounts and things like that to deal with. Or say in a case where you have a wife being abused, a lawyer's perspective or research into legal matters might be useful also. So, it's so many possibilities. That's not what the average pastor looks at, although he has to make a decision based on some of the information which he needs or she needs.
Excuse me to show you my ignorance. What is blogging? Is that an actual term?
Yes.
It is.
It is.
Okay, what?
And you can be forgiven because a lot of people don't know that it's around. It's short for web logging. And if you look at the homework, you were supposed to, and I gave some leads, you were supposed to go and experience it yourself. It's web logging is a new phenomenon which is used over a spectrum there's a spectrum of users. You can use it. Essentially, it is a journal. People use it for journal, and it could be written media. It could be songs that you create and you post on board. It's like a journal, and you can read the journal for yourself. I.e., you are the only person that has access to that journal. More commonly, it is a way for writing something and sharing it with the rest of the world.
Okay.
So you could be writing about your life, and it could be trivial things, it could be very serious things. And there are some blogs. And blogging, the word blog is used like faith, it's used both as a noun and as a verb. So, a blog and blogging, So a blog could be, it really could be anything in the world. And the beauty of it is it allows you to put the URL to put multiple URLs. So for example, I visit a site and I am frustrated with that site. And in my diary I write, today I visited the most awful site in the world. And I put the URL there, and then somebody reading that, today I read, you know, I visited the most awful site, click on that URL, I go straight to the site that the person visited, and then I can go back. You know, so it's immediate access to whatever site that person was visiting online. You know. So for example, I wrote my own personal reflections on preparation for this. My first experience with blogging, then I put the sites that I visited, and then preparing for this. You know, I'm really struggling with getting the readings for this up. Because I want to talk about shaping of a worldview, and oh, I found D.A. Carson's article written on Paul's visit to Athens, and I actually reflected it. And I actually put it all in my blog.
Okay. So then you can make the determination as to if you want others to see it, if you want it just for yourself.
Exactly.
Can you limit the number of people that see it? I mean, can you somehow dictate who it's actually going to look at it?
Okay. And there are people, you know, there's a sort of a gradient, an assessment of what sort of blogger you are. You know, and there are some bloggers that visit their sites like 5 times a day and they write extensively, and some make money out of it because it's a pay-to-view situation. And these are professional journalists who are frustrated with the fact of an editor having to, you know, like take away their stuff and force them into situations. And they write beautiful pieces out there. So it can be done in a very beautiful way. You can also talk about your wonderful sexual experience and, you know, put in your URL all the different sites which are, you know, the awful sites. And I mean, you can use it in any direction you want.
I understand. Yeah.
So, and in this case, it's used in a good way on a regular basis, you know, to communicate amongst teenagers, but there's that slight dark side creeping in as they use that as a means to criticize and also, you know, there's some problem with the way they're using it, and some of my church leaders are concerned that that's what their kids are doing. They are living parallel lives with each other, and that's not very healthy, you see. And that's reflected in the case.
Very interesting. Wow. I learned something.
That's an existing reality. Yeah. Any other comments or questions?
Said this morning that one obstacle for the learning instead of just teaching was that the accreditation institutes were very concerned about teaching and not so much appreciated learning. What are you experiencing in that area?
Well, North America does have accreditation. Accreditation bodies, and actually in North America theological education, there's a major transformation that's happening right now, and that's at the level of assessments. The traditional way of assessment is beginning to be eroded, and the term that Ralph Enlow used was authentic assessments, and the term I've used also here. Authentic assessments begin to focus not so much on your, you know, the final paper that you write, or the exam that you take, but authentic assessments deal with presentations, your portfolio, which could be an article that you write if you're, you know, going that direction, but you could do a workshop in the European Leadership Forum and be assessed for that, you know, because it's a performance related thing.
Were you asking about the difference between teaching and what did he say? Is that what you referred to or not? You know, he was saying, don't call yourselves teachers, but call yourself facilitators of learning. Is that
facilitators of learning? Yeah.
Oh, you.
So what you're talking about what the accreditation agencies, the bodies are.
Yeah.
They were accepting when you change your system from teaching to learning. Because I feel that when we are going to have accreditation, which I'm struggling with now, we try to get a very high academic level, and that includes also the traditional teaching.
You see, the problem with accreditation bodies is that they often demand on you that you do certain things that they wish you to do. I think if you look at the history of accreditation bodies, certainly the American ATS, it was intended to serve. I think it's moving in that direction now, so that there's a major shift in their thinking about how you assess people, moving more towards this authentic assessment situation. If you don't have a movement from within the accreditation body, you're going to have a lot of problems. Because that's what they're going to demand of you. They're not going to recognize authentic assessment because that's not...
On the other hand, I think you're right, there's a movement, but there's so long, so far to go, and there's still resistance in the organization.
Yeah.
So it's not a very happy situation, and Ralph Inlow has stated very openly, publicly in private conversations, you know, that he's not sure, you know, if he's going to stick with it. You know, I mean, he's provost at Columbia, you know, and he literally said, you know, I'm about ready to tell the ATS to take a hike. You know, meaning, if they don't continue that movement toward, you know, real assessment, authentic assessment, then, you know, they might have to consider other alternatives. Now, that's an extreme statement. I'm not saying he's ready to actually do that, but I know he's so frustrated with the process of dealing with the people and realizing that even though they recognize there's a need for change, it's still not forthcoming in a lot of areas because of this resistance. Mm-hmm. Tradition, status quo, tenure, all the things that tend to perpetuate the system as it is.
One of the reasons why our company, this goes back 5-6 years ago, I'm not with the company anymore, but got into what was called learning-based education and training was that the chairman of the board of the company, it was a very large company, it was an $8 billion a year company, said very simply one day, well, how do I know that if all of this money is being spent on quote-unquote education and training that anybody's getting any value out of it? And particularly the board of directors and the stock owners and the stockholders who are spending all this money, you know, what? How do we know that the programs have any value? And he expected a sincere answer, so we came back and had done some studies, you know, to indicate that it was, number one, it was a good question. Number two, it was the reality of it was that there might not have been a whole lot of learning going on, because when you send adults to education and training, particularly in a profit-making environment, it's playtime. You know, it's time to go take 3 days out of your life and go to Atlanta rather than staying in Chicago in your hot old plant and have a good activity. So what we had to do was basically to come back and say, you know, by going to learning-based education and training for adults, what you can do is that there are certain performance enhancements that are built into the learning experience that when they're conducted in a very disciplined format. And that's what he was expecting, that the results will be that you're producing something that can be usable back out onto the factory floor. Now, what that does is that that presents another problem, if you will, because now you got to go back and say, okay, now that the learning has been done, and what is the evidence that the learning is taking hold and it's actually being used? And it is a performance enhancement type of program that is going to be value added. So, you know, it can be rather expensive, I might add, too, particularly the way that we were setting the whole thing up. But the reality of it is does it produce the kinds of results that you would hope that it would produce?
And there are things that perhaps, and it depends on the numbers you're talking about, that could be creatively done to not only get the most out of the training that the people are getting, but actually produce it in the factory. You know, for example, let's say instead of sending 8 people to a training seminar, if you send 3, get them to come back and retrain the other ones.
Exactly.
They're going to work together. They're going to learn teamwork.
Right.
They're going to be more motivated if you give them some extra incentive to those 3 to do a good job, you know, and learning it and then presenting it to the others. You know, it's just one way of trying to increase motivation and increase productivity with, you know, doing things in a more creative fashion.
The other thing we were trying to do was introduce the whole concept of lifelong learning,
mm-hmm.
and the benefits that come from that approach, so that it, you know, it's not just walking into the classroom and, you know, having it for that event, because so much of this stuff ends up being cliff event kind of stuff, and it really ended up having some great value to it.
I think to answer your question, if anybody is convinced, and I'm not convinced that everybody will be convinced that this is a positive way forward, but if an institution is convinced, then you know you need to convince some people that it's worthwhile putting money into that, and that its results justify the change in the assessment strategies. Yeah. You see, all the stuff that the two of you were talking about is so interesting. They are questions that we don't ask in seminary. Because why there's no profit bottom line, you see. Yeah, in a sense. I mean, money seems to be the thing that kind of forces you into a situation of accountability.
Yeah.
But we don't often